Well, good morning, everyone. I always feel as though, like, you should have a shirt that says, "I survived the book of Judges." Yeah. So we've come out of a very dark book to a much shorter and very lovely book. And as I've mentioned before, if you think about even the span of the Old Testament with all the different kinds of narratives that are there, there are not a lot of romantic narratives. There are plenty of domestic narratives. They're husband and wife, but they're not necessarily all that romantic. You know, the courtship of Rebekah by Isaac is kind of one of those romantic moments in Genesis that are pretty few and far between. And you know, that you can read for several pages before there's anything like that. And arguably, you know, in the Old Testament, in terms of the history, Ruth is the most romantic book there. It's something that when you notice a lot of these adaptations that were made in the 1950s, the sand and sandal epics, as they tend to be called. Ten Commandments is obviously the most famous of them. If they're doing the Bible, they always have to introduce some kind of romantic element into it. Like with in the Ten Commandments, of course, the woman who ends up becoming Pharaoh's wife, right, is obviously has this romantic attraction to him. And you've got to introduce that because it's not in the story. There's nothing in the story. And for modern storytelling, there always has to be some kind of romantic aspect to it, or your story is going to move forward. So, but at the same time, you have to remember that the author of Scripture, you know, here in the book of Ruth, probably Samuel, who's also credited as writing Judges, but certainly the divine author, always has an ulterior motive when he talks about romantic love, because remember that is the primary image of the relationship between God and His people, that the people of Israel are God's bride, right? And maybe a bride who's a kind of a run around town bride and a little hard to get to behave bride, but bride nonetheless. And so whenever you see something that's romantic, you always have to bear in mind there's some kind of ulterior motive going on here in terms of, again, helping us understand not just the love of God for His people, but then ultimately the relationship between Christ and His church. Okay, so you're already seeing the ways in which Boaz is described as a kind of a Christ figure, and that Ruth, as a Gentile, is a figure of the Gentile church or the Gentile converts who will come in. One of the questions that I asked just before we started is Moab one of the territories that would have been conquered? No, Moab and Ammon are outside the Promised Land. They make trouble for the Promised Land, but they're not formally in it. It's the Canaanites. Remember, the Canaanites, Philistines, those folks who are actually in the Promised Land. So there are stricter prohibitions about the Canaanites in terms of marriage than there are about the Moabites and Ammonites who are outside. At the time that this is being carried out, there isn't an explicit prohibition against marrying a Moabite. When the chosen people come back, so in the time of Nehemiah, then there start to be the prohibitions are stricter, that you're not supposed to be marrying these outsiders. But here, you know, there's she comes in as a proselyte. She comes in as somebody who's accepting, you know, the God of the Hebrew people. Your God will be my God. Now, I mentioned this last time, but I thought, you know, I should probably just write this out. Here it is from the book of Matthew, from the genealogy at the beginning of the book. Solomon is the one who marries Rahab. Remember Rahab who hid the spies? And there, at least in the gospel narrative, Boaz, you know, is their son. He marries Ruth. Their child is Obed, who is the father of Jesse, who is the father of David the king. Okay? And as one commentator puts it, you know, you have all these just terrible things that happen in the time of Judges. And, you know, this book is set at that time. You're told in the time when there were judges. But with all the great warfare and conflict and whatnot, the most important thing that happens is that these two people fall in love. The most important thing that happens is they fall in love and marry, and they are the great grandparents of David, great grandma, great granddad. Yep.
And then it keeps going on in Matthew to talk about the fact that eventually this Jacob is the father of Joseph,
mm-hmm.
who is the father of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. You'd think that Mary would come from that, you know?
She does.
She does because she's from the same line. She's also.
Okay.
Karen, you want to pipe up on that one?
In Matthew, it mentions Joseph.
I forgot how they're related, but they both are from the same lineage.
Okay.
Judaism comes through the mother. It doesn't? That's what I was always told.
Okay, at the time of Jesus, it would have been the father.
Yeah, because this is a patrilineal line, so that's why it's Joseph.
Then as intermarriage became more of a commonplace within Judaism, they switched it to the mother.
So that's later.
Because
okay.
You can always tell who the child came from in that instance.
Got it. Thank you. Okay, so that's a later development.
I guess.
No, it was a very... No, that's it.
Kind of said, we know.
It's in the Odyssey. It is a wise man who knows his own father. That you, a woman always knows that the child is hers, and the father takes it on faith. Unless you just have these glaring genetic traits, your red hair or a cleft chin, or sometimes there are certain things. Now, this is my boy. You know, there's certain things that give it away. So Ruth, on the one hand, is important within the context of the Old Testament because these are the great grandparents of David the king, who's obviously central to the Old Testament narrative. Panning back, this is important for salvation history because yes, these are the great grandparents of David the king, but they are also the ancestors of our Lord himself, and they provide a kind of figure in their romance for who Jesus is and what he does for the Gentile church, for this, again, this group that's coming in, that's being converted. Yep.
In our group, one of our members had mentioned that for Orpah, one of her descendants was Goliath.
I've seen that before, and as I recall in the thing that I was looking at, that's out of the Hebrew tradition, or there's some Hebrew commentators but there's an argument about whether that's right or not. In fact, it turns on whether or not the name has been transcribed correctly or. You know what I mean? Because you're taking names out of one language and putting them in a different language. In any event, that's talked about in Cornelius a Lapide. He takes on that opinion that Orpah is the father of is the ancestor of Father Goliath, and he argues against it. But I'm going to admit that I read that paragraph once and I thought, oh, that's interesting. But if you want to hear more about that, I can bring it back to you. But apparently, that view is out there. There were some. Jewish commentators interpreted that way, but it turns on whether the name has been transcribed correctly or recorded accurately. You always want people in the Bible to be related to each other in various ways, you know, and it isn't always so neat. Background: who and where? There is a famine that we read of in the Holy Land, and. That's why they leave. And in fact, these two young men who go with Naomi, Mahlon, that name means sick, and Kilon, that name means pining. So commentators will talk about evidently these children are named in times of scarcity. You know, I know these people name in totally different ways from us, don't they? I mean, they aren't sitting there with the name your baby book, you know, going, oh, how about Aspen? How about Mackenzie? How about, you know, they aren't, that sounds good. You know, they aren't doing it that way. They're, the naming that they do either reflects some kind of relative who's being named after. Think about the naming of John in the Gospel of Luke, where they just expect him to meet him after his father, Zechariah. They just expect that, and then there's this deviation. Or there are these circumstances which give rise to the name. And so you're named after your birth circumstances. And that appears to be what's going on here. So Naomi and these sons, they're in Moab, just outside the Holy Land. The sons marry Moabite girls, and then that comes to an end. Both these boys die, and it didn't look very promising for them from the start, did it? I mean, at the point where they have names like Sick and Pining, I don't know if you want to put your money on that. If you had a horse, would you put your money on horses that had that name? In any event, Naomi with her two daughters, now daughters-in-law, and she just expects that they're going to go back to their people and remarry. And Orpah evidently has some attachment to her mother, but you know, she sort of escorts her to the border, and that's the extent of her attachment. But Ruth makes this beautiful proclamation that, you know, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Okay, so again, like what we see earlier with Rahab, that when we heard of the way that, you know, you would beat those people out in the desert, you beat up these guys and beat up those guys, you know, we knew that your God was the Lord of heaven and earth. Right, Rahab makes this beautiful proclamation of faith. And now here's Ruth making something very similar, only for her it isn't because she's seen some kind of great battle. It's evidently something in this way of life that her mother-in-law, that Naomi shows her, that she becomes attached to, that she admires, and she won't leave her. So most of the action of the story after they leave Moab is in Bethlehem. And, you know, commentators will point out, when you look in the book of Judges, a lot of the things in the latter chapters that happen around Bethlehem, they're all really ugly. You know, a lot of these incidents in 17 through 21 in Judges. And so here, Bethlehem, as it were, if you like, redeems itself. There's this lovely story now of this romance between them. How do they meet? They meet because she's basically out in the fields getting the leavings of what the harvesters have left behind, right? That's what gleaning is. So they go through and they, you know, pick, you know, the easiest things to pick or the largest portions or whatnot. And then you always have this stuff that's around that for them is just too much work to get. Well, so then the poorer people, they're allowed to go through the fields and kind of pick up the leavings. There was a book that I ran across when I was preparing. Where's my marker? Here we go. There was this book, and I feel as though I should share this book with you. W.C. William McClure, is it Thompson? I think it's Thompson. William McClure Thompson. Yeah, I think that's it. So I'm sure of the title. William McClure Thompson, and it's called The Land and the Book. The Land and the Book. And William McClure Thompson was an American missionary, Protestant missionary, in Syria during, let's say, I want to say like the 1830s, 1840s, but he was there for like 30 years. And he would travel, of course, down to Israel all the time for various reasons. He got around in various parts of the Middle East. And what he did when he wrote this book was he was describing these places in the Near East in light of Scripture. So when he gets to the book, when he gets to Bethlehem, he talks about how it is that, you know what, when you meet Ruth, he's out in the fields gleaning. You can see that now. This is still happening, where you have the out in the barley fields, these people come along in the wheat fields. They come and do the harvest, and then these people who are sort of poor or less economically well, there they are, following behind, picking up the leftovers. So you have this powerful sense of how fundamentally things haven't changed. He's writing this in like the 1830s, 1840s, and it's the same thing. By the way, Land in the Book, when it was published in the United States, it was a bestseller for about a decade. It was right behind Uncle Tom's Cabin, which, if you remember, was another just bestseller when it came out. Remember, Lincoln said to Harriet Beecher Stowe when he met her, "So you're the little lady who caused this great big war," because there were so many Northerners whose outlook on the South had been formed by Uncle Tom's Cabin. In any event, right behind that was William W.C. Thompson's Land in the Book. So lots and lots of people were reading about how the various sites in the Holy Land, again, what they look like, what they look like today, how the people were living there, and a lot of it's the same. That's the thing that I think sometimes as Americans, our way of life, our technology, our wealth, all those things, and this would be true for Western Europeans, it'd be true for other chunks of people out there, but it's like our way of life is completely discontinuous with everything before it. So when you look at things from, let's say, 1900 or even 1950, they look alien. And it's one of the biggest problems for our young people in learning history. They're learning about places and peoples and cultures that are completely alien to their lived experience. Completely alien. In a way that when you read things like Thompson's book, you realize there are these parts of the world that, okay, you can throw in some televisions and bicycles and, you know, some of these technological things, but fundamentally, things are the same century after century after century. Okay. Now, there are all sorts of advantages about that. There are all sorts of disadvantages. But one of the disadvantages that we have with our very advanced way of life is we read things like the Book of Ruth, and it's like we have to relearn all these customs that lots and lots of people live and still live with all over the place in a way that Central Africans, when they were evangelized and they had the Bible translated into their own language, they're not looking at this like the Hebrew people of their time had various interesting customs, right? They can read it and recognize many of the customs and hardships and difficulties as their own. They don't need a translation of experience. For us, we need a translation of language and then a translation of experience. For people at a lower level of affluence and technology and development, all they need is a translation of language. They are sharing the same experiences. Go ahead.
I went to Beth El Synagogue, located on right next to Benilde St. Margaret's.
Yeah.
The one that looks like a ski slope.
Yep.
And they said this was designed like the tent of Abraham. And I was like, okay, that's okay, cool. Yeah. And then I went to Israel and sat in a Bedouin tent. And it's identical. I mean, how it was designed and everything. And I'm looking around. I said, it really is like the tent of Abraham. And the tour guide explained the tent and how it worked. And
yes.
Yes, that makes absolute sense. So it put it into context.
Yep. And generally, that's like gratifying and surprising. And I think for many Americans, they don't find that gratifying and surprising. They don't like that at all. They don't want continuity. They want something that's absolutely new. Remember, for us, new means it's good. We almost have the prejudice of new meaning good. Whereas for people who are in a traditional society, new means suspect or bad. You know, the connotations are completely different because it's as if we have these ways that we've kind of tried and tested and they've worked for us. Oh, okay, now you've got a new idea. Well, how do you know that's going to work? And again, that can make you conservative, little c conservative, in a very bad way, right? You shut out all sorts of things that would actually improve anything. But the converse is that it really does allow you to have this kind of accumulated wisdom of the ages that informs what it is you do and how you look. Whereas for us, we tend to be very gullible to what's new. You know, so some study from somewhere shows something that's completely the opposite of what we've always believed. We just think that's so exciting, you know. And so we tend to be gullible for the new. Not just open to the new, but flat out gullible. Anyway, to continue. The beginning of the wheat harvest in the Hebrew calendar took place during the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, what they call Pentecost. And so this is when the book of Ruth was read in Hebrew synagogue. It was read during this Feast of Weeks, in other words, to mark that the harvest. And you're told that 1:23, right? That's when they're out there harvesting the barley. Now, she's out there and she's very very attentive, in fact, to her mother-in-law. You know, notice that she has this conversation, and you know, Boaz takes notice of her, but she's given some kind of hospitality. She's, you know, have a drink or whatnot. She does the minimum, and she wants to go immediately back to her mother-in-law. In other words, she's not some, but her dedication is shown in these very kind of brief sketches, that she's someone who is not just attentive to her own comfort, but she really is devoted to her mother-in-law. She really is devoted to making sure that they have enough to eat and they have enough to live on. And evidently, there's something about her that's attractive to Boaz, because he takes notice. Now, Boaz, his name means strength. Okay, so let's see. She was previously married to this guy Sick, and now this guy Strength shows up. What do you think's going to happen? So, the beautiful courtship they have, as I mentioned already, is meant to be this, meant to represent this union of Christ and the church. If we look at it in, is this St. Jerome? Well, here, this is, Wordsworth puts it nicely. He puts it in this way. Boaz himself is represented in this history, is in so many respects a figure of Christ. His name, signifying strength, is expressive of Christ. He is of Bethlehem, of the tribe of Judah, where David was. So is Christ. Boaz comes forth as the Lord of the harvest among the reapers. So does Christ. He winnows on his threshing floor. So as he is proclaimed by the Baptist as having a fan in his hand. Remember, this is the way that John the Baptist describes our Lord, that he comes to sift and to winnow, right? That it expresses the way in which, there's this response that has to happen, you know, when our Lord comes. There are those who are open, who receive the kingdom, and those who aren't. And you can describe that as a kind of a sifting, as a kind of winnowing. He falls asleep. Again, Boaz. And when he awakes, he espouses himself to Ruth the Moabitess, and redeems her inheritance as the next of kin to her departed husband. Christ himself, next of kin to us, by taking our nature, the nature of those who are dead in sin. He falls asleep in death on the cross, and when he awakes by his resurrection, he redeems our inheritance for us, and espoused to himself a spiritual Ruth, a church from all nations, and he has raised up thereby a spiritual seed, glorious forevermore. Okay. So, in Moab, Moab is not just, you know, this gracious, you know, man of Judah who's now in love with this young Moabitess. He is a figure of Christ. By the way, I found my title here. It is William McClure Thompson, Land of the Book, and the subtitle was Biblical Illustrations of the Holy Land. So again, he's writing at a time that people aren't going to be able to go over and see the Holy Land, so he describes it for them in detail. That's the reference here. So when she comes to, remember, she comes to Boaz, and there's this expression that he has about of covering her or providing shelter for her, spreading wings over her. Ruth comes to Boaz. Ruth coming to Bethlehem came for shelter under the wings of the Lord of Israel. As we see, she came to shelter under the wings of Boaz. That's actually right in the next chapter. So in at the beginning of chapter 3. There's this very unusual way in which she seeks his seeks his hand or gets him to seek her hand, that she comes in the middle of the night and he covers her with his mantle, and we'll have to talk about that a bit next week, but in the language again of one of the Anglican commentaries, Ruth the Moabitess, leaving her national idolatries, coming forth in faith and love with her mother-in-law to Bethlehem, lays down herself as a humble handmaid and suppliant at the feet of Boaz of Judah on the threshing floor, and espoused to him at that place, which afterward witnessed the nativity of Christ, the Son of God, who came forth from heaven as a bridegroom to join our nature to the divine in an indissoluble union in himself. Again, that this courtship is happening at Bethlehem. Remember when we talked earlier about how marriage is not just a figure of the union of the chosen people with God in the sense of like the church, but remember, even within Christ himself, that the union of God and man in Christ is signified by a marriage, right? That the incarnation is a kind of marriage between God and man. And it's that union of man and God to which all of us, we're not united by nature, right? That's only in Christ Jesus. But that we're united to God in grace and glory. Okay? So that in the when you see this marriage between Boaz and Ruth, or this espousement that happens, that is a foreshadowing, again, not just of the love of God for his people, but that union, that intimate union that happens between God and man in the incarnation. So there's a way in which this is even a figure of that, insofar as it happens in Bethlehem. Let me pause here. Questions or observations that you have as you've been, if you've seen this book, or as you've been, it's so much nicer, so much more nicer than Judges. Go ahead, Karen.
Hey, there's one piece, because we always focus in on where you will go, I will go, where you will lodge, I will lodge, you, your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. The next sentence that she utters is an oath, by the name of the Lord. So she doesn't just do it, she acts upon it, and that oath is actually bigger than the first piece, because she's actually using God's name, and she realizes the power, the authority, etc., that name has.
That can make it into the song.
So we don't know it. Because
it says, I will be buried. Where you die, I will die. And then, may the Lord do also to me.
Yes, okay, yep.
More so. And that also goes back to, I forget, I'm going to screw it up, but I think it's Abraham, when God makes the covenant,
yes,
between the two halves.
Yep, yep.
And the two halves actually represent the destruction. And God says, if the destruction of these animals, if I do not fulfill my covenant with you, this will be my fate. And he's swearing by his own name.
Yeah, it's almost like when you were a child. I don't know if children do this anymore, but, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. You call upon these terrible things to happen to you if you don't. But that's, you're right. That's what she's calling down upon herself. if she doesn't fulfill it, and that's going back to Abraham's covenant with God. That's what he does. When you're swearing an oath, you are calling down some kind of divine retribution. And stick a needle in my eye when you're like 9 years old. I mean, that's about as big a divine retribution as you can think of.
That's why we also have two halves. When a married couple goes down the center, generally the central aisle,
yes,
of a synagogue or a church, it's to replicate this, the oath.
Oh, that I did not. That is news to me.
Yes.
I thought it was just to keep the in-laws apart. Isn't that the joke? What's the difference between outlaws and in-laws? Mm-hmm. Outlaws are wanted. So. other things, other questions or comments on Ruth? Go ahead, Cesarian.
Mrs. Tamil brought up a good point in our group. She had said that Naomi tells her daughters-in-laws to go back, she says, go return each of you to her mother's house. And in those days, it was mostly the men that take care of, you know, the daughters or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that Naomi would say, go to your mother's house. Mm-hmm. Why would she say that?
I don't immediately know. The only thing I can think of is that to name it in terms of the mother, because the mother would be more more attentive and more sympathetic. That's the first thing that comes to me, is that the mother is going to be more solicitous for their, you know, for their future, that they marry or remarry, that would be more of the woman's province to see to. It's not that the husband wouldn't care, but the women generally are going to be the ones who govern marriage, and especially new marriage, even if the husband signs off on it or the father signs off on it. That would be my reflexive. I don't know if other folks have other ideas. Other things that, yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering if the Moabites did not want their daughters to marry the Israelites, if it went the other way.
They don't have the same prohibitions. Because remember, you could have the, for them it would have been purely practical. In other words, they wouldn't have a principle against the Israelites. They didn't invade their territory. They're irritating neighbors, but you know, there isn't. Remember, the Israelites are supposed to have a horror against these other people because of idolatry and the things that are connected with idolatry. Whereas all of these other people in relation to each other, they just have the same attachments or dislikes that any pagan group of people have for each other. So that there's this kind of special abhorrence for your religion because your religion does X or Y. That's, you know, that's new. I mean, remember, we think of that as being something that's essential to religion. That you've got a book you believe in, that it's your special book, and that there are these outsiders who don't believe the book, and therefore you condemn them and so on. That's world religion. You know, that's Quran, Bible, and so on. In the pagan world, they tended very quickly to look at each other's gods as equivalents. So in other words, when the Romans would go to Egypt and they would run into Anubis and Set and Ra and Isis, they would think, aha, this is just like Jupiter or Venus or Demeter. They would keep looking for equivalents. And they would recognize that there were some things that fell outside that, but pretty much it was like the same set of things, only you gave them different names. And when you read Platonic dialogues, when you read Plato talking about these other religions, that's how they tend to think of it. So that someone would come along and say, do you know what? All of you guys are like completely wrong. And there's this one all-powerful God that you need to figure out. That's relatively new. Now, occasionally, if you know anything about Egyptian history, Akhenaten did this. Akhenaten said there's one God, it's the sun. And there aren't all these dog-headed gods and jackal-headed gods. And he built his own city with its own temple. He left the traditional, you know, place of worship, the capital, and built this temple to the Aten. And Then he dies, and right, it all disappears, and so on. But the earliest hymn we have to a monotheistic God is this hymn to the Aten from ancient Egypt. But anyway, that was odd. You know, that was distinctly odd. So now we tend to think of religion in those terms, that there's some kind of revealed thing that transcends what people figure out in their own homegrown religions. So the Moabites, Ammonites, all those people, the Israelite insistence that there's this God that's the real God, and their God isn't some kind of real God. Remember that when Naomi talks to these girls, and she even tells them, go back to your gods. I mean, it really does sound like there are these, you know, local gods. You know, we're in Moab. This is Moab God territory. Now we're in Ammonite God territory. That's almost how they thought of it. They thought of their gods in very local ways. So that there would be some, as Rahab puts it, that your God is the Lord of heaven. You know, that your God somehow has power over other gods no matter where they are. That is a revolutionary idea. Not revolutionary in the sense that, I mean, God was there from the beginning, you know, it's just that it's revolutionary when you forgot it. It's revolutionary when you have cultures that have strayed further and further away from God and they don't remember anymore. Other thoughts or comments? Right now with the, you know, we're talking here about marriage and whatnot, and right now with the sophomores, I just started the unit on marriage and family. And, you know, so this is a lovely book to have kind of in the back of your mind as you're talking about it. But, you know, the difficulty is, I think for so many of them, you know, if I were to just put it in a phrase, you know, our young people have grown up in a contraceptive society. They've gone up in a society in which sexuality and procreation of children are detached from each other. And so that's, I think, part of the reason why they're so open to homosexual relationships and homosexual love. It isn't just that they see it on TV all the time. The other thing that's going on there is they do not see why children and sexual love necessarily go together. They don't see that, and it's largely detached in their, you know, in their experience. For them, because they know they grow up in a society where there are condoms and birth control pills and vasectomies, fertility is this thing that you can turn on and off. You know, it's like a faucet. And I will always get, when I will talk about how children are the end of marriage, I will always get kids who ask things like, what if you want to get married but you just don't want to have children? And I mean, that's a very ordinary question for them. And the thing that's very striking about that is you almost feel as though they have not experienced people who like can't have children. I mean, I have to tell them, there are people who spend thousands of dollars on fertility treatments because they can't have children. You know, think of how much in the Old Testament, throughout the Old Testament, how often you encounter this woman who's unable to have a child, and the great sorrow and the great heartache that is. That isn't like some remarkable Hebrew experience. People in the ancient world wanted to have children. That's human. That is human. But I think for many of our young people, it's like they think, well, you know, they think of children as the option. In other words, it's not that children are kind of a natural outgrowth of sexual love. It's children are a kind of lifestyle option. So, you know, sex could be about recreation. It could be about just expressing relationship. It could be a form of self-expression. And then, you know, like getting a car. You know, do you want, you know, the backup video thing? Do you want it to stop when it senses that other cars are on there? Okay, do you want children? Are those, oh, you want that as an add-on option? Okay, right, we'll put that on. So the thing that I was just talking about today with them, I was kind of walking them through the kind of historical background to Costa Canubi. Costa Canubi is still the most recent papal encyclical on marriage from 1930. Still the most recent. Even though John Paul II devoted a lot of attention to marriage, he never devoted an encyclical to it. So Costa Canubi remains the most recent encyclical on marriage. But I talk about it, the trigger for that encyclical was the Lambeth Conference of 1930 of the Church of England. The Church of England was the first Christian community to allow its members to use artificial birth control. 1930. Before that, all Christians, Protestant, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, we were all on board about artificial contraception being wrong. Now, by the way, I said that years ago, and I remember I had this lovely Wisconsin Synod Lutheran girl who told me, "You mean other Lutherans allow contraception?" She was appalled. Apparently Missouri Synod Lutherans and Wisconsin Synod Lutherans still follow the old teaching of Luther, that there's something wrong with that. Yes, dear, you have to get out. You really have to get out a bit more and see how the other Lutherans are living. Think about how it is the Comstock laws. Remember the sale and advertisement, especially through the mail, of contraception in the United States. That was illegal. That was illegal all through the late 1800s into the early 1900s. It's only at the same time, it's only in the 1930s, 1910s and 30s, that you start to get laws that allow the advertisement and sale of contraception in the United States. In the United States. And that was Protestant majorities. That wasn't like some kind of Catholic cabal, you know, to keep contraception illegal. Griswold versus Connecticut happened because there was this desire to get the last remaining laws against contraception overturned. Okay. Now, I give them that history because they have grown up with all of these things being normal. So when you talk about marriage to them and chastity and what marriage is about, it's like you've got to recover these original experiences of human sexuality for them. Think about this for a moment. Think of, again, even with the best governance that you try to manage with them, you know, they're going to see lots of people making out, canoodling, and otherwise physically intimate in movies and television. And I shared with them this. Many years ago, I was watching Ron Howard's Backdraft. Most of the actors get out-acted by the fire. It's a movie about firefighting, and I think the fire really gets best actor in that movie. But one of the interesting things in that movie is Kurt Russell, who's one of these firefighters, is back at his house with his estranged wife, played by Rebecca De Mornay, and they start passionately kissing in bed. And I realized watching this that I think this is the first time that in a movie that I've seen two people who are about to make love who are married. So think about that impression on your children. All the romantic love that they ever see is between people who are not married. That is absolutely, most importantly here, emotionally normal to them. And at the point where that becomes emotionally normal, then you've detached sexuality in children. They're accidentally related to each other. So this is a long way of saying that in teaching young people about these things, a lot of this is uphill. But it's uphill because of the emotional responses that the culture gives them. And all of these things, the detachment of romance and love from children or family is simply so normal that when you talk about them being together, you get these kind of quizzical looks. You know, like, well, that's an interesting point of view, you know, but you really have to sell them on that because they aren't inclined to buy it. Go ahead, Mrs. DeWeel.
What was the name of the encyclical again?
Costa Canubii. So C, here, I'll write it down.
What does that mean?
It means chaste marriage. It means chaste marriage. So Costa Canubii. Okay, Costa Canubii, it's Pius the 11th. One of my faves. Pius the 11th has these wonderful, wonderful encyclicals. And I used to use it as a text with sophomores. And I found that I just kept getting squeezed for time. I would have them read chunks of it. And now I use the catechism and I try to hit the high points. But basically the structure of Costa Canubii is it's based on the marriage goods. So fertility, fidelity sacrament. And then it describes how it is that the unraveling of marriage in the modern world comes from the rejection of those three goods. So contraception, that's what unravels fertility, right? Sexuality and children become detached. Sacrament, that's what essentially Luther and Calvin do. When they deny that marriage is a sacrament, that opens the door to divorce because now marriage is breakable, right? The indissolubility and sacrament are two things that go together. And Luther explicitly rejects marriage as a sacrament. Same with Calvin. In fact, Luther will say the arguments that are given for marriage being a sacrament are ridiculous. You know, his language is very, very strong. Okay? And then fidelity. Now that we have things like open, essentially forms of open marriage, that's what argues against fidelity, that marriage doesn't have to be exclusive. When I tackle the issue of same-sex marriage with young people, I tend to come with what I would describe as a kind of a flanking maneuver. I show them these two articles, one from the New York Times, one from the San Francisco Chronicle, where the writers are arguing that the important thing about same-sex marriage is that it's not exclusive. So they're interviewing, one is a lesbian couple, the other is two men, and they're talking about how what grounds their relationship is that they're permitted play with people outside the marriage. Okay, and the reason that I have our young people read that is because they are thinking of homosexual marriage as simply being like a man and a woman, only you're just trading out the partners. You're just putting in a man in place of a woman or a woman in place of a man, and everything else stays the same. And these are not attack pieces. This is the New York Times. This is the San Francisco Chronicle. These are not attack pieces. These are evangelical. What they're trying to, you know, this is what makes our marriage work, is that we have these forms of sexual release outside of our partner. And you heterosexuals, you would be happier if your marriages weren't exclusive. That is what is killing your marriages. And so the reason I have them read this is because I want them to understand, if marriage is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily about coming together and having children, it makes perfect sense that it's exclusive. But if marriage isn't about that, then there is no logical reason why it is that it has to be exclusive. You've lost the logic for why it is that it has to be exclusive. And more than anything else, that's at least what I want them to get, is whatever ideas you're going to have out there about human sexuality, they should at least be logically related to each other. And what I think our young people have is kind of a Christian sentimentalism. Not really Christian teaching, but almost like Christian sentimentalism. Romantic comedy movie sentimentalism. And then sort of this hard science view that they get about people being hardwired for adultery or homosexuality or anything else. So they've got this kind of casserole. And yeah, they've got this kind of casserole of conflicting ideas. And please, the least, I may not be able to sell you on the Catholic teaching, but I at least want you to have something that's coherent, something that fits together, as opposed to this hodgepodge that you think works but really doesn't. So we'll continue with the Book of Ruth next time. Thank you.
Didn't he have a pen that went around with the...
Oh, no.
This one?
Yeah.